Now would you find, please, the book of Esther. The book of Esther. Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther. Or if you prefer, open your Bible in the middle to Psalms and work back just a couple of books and you come to the book of Esther. This is the last of our series for the moment, one book at a time. We're going to have a break and then we will come back again to this series. We have done a good many, I think nearly half of the Bible we have surveyed. Now the book of Esther is a fascinating book. It's a storybook and it is set in Persia, or Iran as it is now known, very much in the news today. Iran. Since 1935 it has been called Iran, but we know it better as Persia. And at one time this was a great superpower in the world, the great empire of the Persians. And the story of Esther is set after the first return of the Jewish exiles from exile in Babylon under Zerubbabel, which was about the year 537 BC. It's set after that, but it is set before the return of Ezra with another lot in about 458, and of course, therefore, before the return of Nehemiah to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem about the year 433, and that Nehemiah was the book we were looking at last week. Now, there are several interesting things to say about the book of Esther by way of introduction. First of all, it is a story, and a very interesting story as well. So if you don't know the story, you're in for a very interesting story. Boys and girls, tonight, I hope you know the story of Esther, and if not, you'll certainly be interested in it. Secondly, it is one of only two books in the Bible called by a woman's name. Anybody in Covenanters? Tell me the name of the other one. Two. Near the boys' nose? Ruth. Good. The girls knew straight away, of course, but the boys are a little slower. Ruth. Ruth and Esther. Good. The third thing which is of interest is that there is no mention of God in the whole of this book. That really surprises many people. Here is a book in the Bible, a book in the Old Testament, a book that was in Jesus' Bible, and yet there's no mention of God in it. That doesn't mean that God isn't in it, but his name is not mentioned and the word God is not mentioned. And the fourth interesting thing is that it is the most well-known and popular book amongst the Jews, nevertheless, to this very day. And there are more ancient manuscripts on the book of Esther, than any other book from the Old Testament. Now, I wonder why that is. Well, it's to do with the Feast of Purim, P-U-R-I-M. And later on in the book, we shall see why the Jews keep the feast, because that's what Esther is all about. But once a year, the Jews have the Feast of Purim. Of course, just as we have our Christian festivals, so the Jews have their festivals. Passover, Tabernacles, Pentecost, and so on. And Purim is one of their feasts. It's in the 12th month, 13th, and then particularly the 14th and the 15th of that month, which corresponds to round about our February-March time. And the first day is a fast day, and then the next 2 days are feasting days. And on that day, they go to the synagogue, and they read through aloud the book of Esther during the Feast of Purim. And there's a baddie in the book of Esther whose name is Haman. We shall come to him. And whenever the name Haman is read out, as the rabbi is reading aloud from the book of Esther, when he reads out the name Haman, they all boo and stamp their feet and hiss and even take football rattles along and make as much horrible noise as they possibly can. It reminds me of when I was a boy and I was allowed to go to the Saturday morning children's cinema club. Now, when I was a boy, cinemas for Christian families were not on. and we didn't go. But my father made an exception eventually with the Saturday morning children's cinema club. And so I used to go along there. What the poor manager, I think there were more nervous breakdowns and coronaries amongst cinema managers because of those children's cinema clubs than anything else. And we used to see space odysseys that were like serialized about a fellow called Flash Gordon. It dates me. And then there was a cowboy called Roy Rogers. And, well, I go back a bit. Now, the point is this. When the baddie came on, we used to hiss and boo. And then it would switch all of a sudden to the goodies that were after them. Not the goodies, but not the goodies. And we used to clap and cheer. And that was all part of the fun. And I think the people making the films used to deliberately do it this way, keep switching from the bad ones to the good ones on the chase so that you could boo or hiss. And you'd be surprised that people will do this in a place of worship, but this is what the Jews do during the Feast of Purim. And the Book of Esther is read out loud. And when it's the goodies, they cheer, and when it's the baddies, they hiss and boo. Now, I said that there is no mention of the name of God. However, some people who do very careful studies of these things claim that on four occasions in the Hebrew of the Book of Esther, the four consonants of the name Jehovah or Yahweh, J-H-V-H, occur as the initial letters of four consecutive words. And so they feel that's not a coincidence, so they think the writer was hiding the name of God in that way in the Book of Esther, but it could have been, I suppose, a coincidence. Why doesn't he mention God? Possibly in order not to anger the Persians. But as we shall see, God is behind the story. So let's begin then in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia, a tremendous empire over 127 provinces. In those days, when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the capital, in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his princes and servants, the army chiefs of Persia and Media, and the nobles and the governors of the provinces being before him. What did he do? He showed the riches of his royal glory for 180 days. So it was 180 days, 6 months, march past of all his military might and a display of his glory. And then at the end of all that, and there was a reason for it which we'll come back to, he gave a week's feast, and it was quite some banquet. It was in the garden of the king's palace, verse 6, there were white cotton curtains, blue hanging, caught up with the cords of fine linen, and it goes on to speak of the wonderful mosaic pavements, the marble, the mother of pearl. Drinks were served in golden goblets, each golden goblet was different, and no one was compelled to drink, but on the other hand, there was much as anyone wanted. Now the queen wasn't there, verse 9, Queen Vashti, she was also giving a banquet for the women in the palace. Now, on the seventh day, verse 10, Ahasuerus, whose other name, by the way, is Xerxes. And in history, he's known by that name much more than Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is his Hebrew name. Xerxes, X-E-R-X-E-S, Xerxes, is his Greek name. He was getting very drunk by the end of the feast, and he decided that he would command his queen to come and display her beauty before all his guests, and she refused. Verse 12. Now, we're not told why she refused. It may have been because in that oriental land, queens did not display themselves before people except their husbands, and this was degrading for her, and she refused to do it, even if it would cost her life. Well, the king was very angry, it says in verse 12, and he consulted with his wise men, especially his superstitious astrologers and so on, as to what should be done. And they said, well, this is not only an affront to you, sir, it is an affront to every man in the kingdom. When people get to hear of this throughout the whole of your fantastic empire, which is the biggest empire the world has ever known, when all the wives get to hear of what your wife has done to you, they'll all start rebelling against their husbands. And where shall we be then? The empire will crumble. There'll be no respect at all. And he appreciated that that was so. So he said, what shall I do? And so they said, well, make a decree that Vashti is to be deposed and probably divorced, and that every husband is to rule in his own house, every wife is to give honor to her husband, and if it's a mixed marriage of mixed languages, it's the husband's language that has to be spoken in the house. So there. And that comes at the end of chapter 1. So this decree went out, and they told the king to find himself another wife. Now chapter 2, after these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti. That might suggest he missed her. And he remembered what he had decreed, and he decided that he must find himself another wife. Now, that's very interesting after these things, because as a matter of fact, about 4 years had gone by. And if you know your Persian Greek history, you know that a lot of very interesting things was happening during those 4 years. You see, there were a succession, weren't there, of superpowers. There was the Assyrians, we learnt a bit about them. They were conquered by the Babylonians, Nebuchadnezzar and all that. That was a bigger empire still. But then along came the Persians, Cyrus. That was a bigger empire still. Now, on their western frontier, they were trying to subdue these rebellious Greeks, Athens and Sparta and all those places. And they were having a bad time of it. Not because the Greeks were all that powerful, but they were very brave. And they had some disastrous wars with the Greeks. Xerxes, they found in one of his capitals, they have found an inscription dating back to his own time. And this is what he humbly said about himself on this inscription. I am Xerxes, the great king, the only king, the king of all countries, the king of this big and far-reaching earth. So modesty was not one of his assets. But he wasn't the king of all the far-reaching earth because the Greeks were giving him trouble. Well, you'll have to read in your history books how about this time of the book of Esther, 480 BC, with an army of some have estimated 5 million men and a tremendous fleet of ships, he went to subdue the Greeks. He was humiliated at the Battle of Thermopylae when a handful of men died holding the straits under the brave Leonidas, and he was defeated at sea at the Battle of Salamis. And so he came back and decided he'd better get on with finding another wife and leave the Greeks alone for a bit. And so they decided to hold a beauty contest throughout the land, find many beautiful girls to bring to the king's harem, because those were very immoral days and kings had many girls in their harem, but they didn't have the status of queen. But one of them was to be chosen as queen. Now, chapter 2, verse 5. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the capital, whose name was Mordecai. Now that's where everybody cheers in the synagogue, because along comes Mordecai. The son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjaminite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. Well, the who of verse 6 probably refers to Kish, his grandfather, rather than Mordecai himself, because that would make Mordecai otherwise 120 years old, and it was doubtful if he was that old. Now, Mordecai, this Jew in Susa, or Shushan, the capital city of Persia, had a beautiful cousin who had been orphaned, and he had brought her up as if she was his own daughter. She was beautiful and she was lovely. Her Hebrew name was Hadassah, verse 7, but she had been called Esther, either after a goddess of the Babylonians, Ishtar, or else after the Persian word star, from which we get our word star. Esther. And that was her name. But she was rounded up because of her beauty, and she was put in the king's harem. And she was a Jewess, but Mordecai, her cousin and guardian, told her not to let on that she was Jewish. And she found favour with the eunuch who was in charge of the harem, Hegai, and he gave her some maids to look after her and extra food. And in chapter 2 we read that it took a year for these girls to have their beauty treatment. Some of them maybe came from places where their skin had become hardened or something. Anyway, there was 12 months where they were they used various oils and things to make themselves beautiful. Well, they had to go into the king one at a time, and when he was pleased with one of them, he would choose her as his queen. And it happened to Esther. Verse 17 of chapter 2, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found grace and favour in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And then they had a great party. And all the time that she was in there, Mordecai, who seems to have had a job in one of the outer gateways of the palace, kept in touch with her, particularly through an intermediary. And while he was doing his job, Mordecai overheard of a plot to assassinate the king. Two men were talking, and they were plotting to assassinate Xerxes or Ahasuerus. So he told the queen, Esther, and she warned the king. And the king's life was saved, and these two would-be assassins were hanged on the gallows, and that fact was recorded in their chronicles. Now chapter 3. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite. Boo, here comes the bad man. And he became very, very popular with the king, and he made him his prime minister. And everybody was to bow down and do the same as worship to this man Haman. But Mordecai, verse 3, would not bow down or do obeisance. And that really angered Haman. And they spoke to Mordecai and tried to get him to do it, but he wouldn't do it. He told them, verse 4, that he was a Jew. So it may have been that he felt that this was worshipping Haman. And as a Jew, he would worship only God. I don't know whether that was the reason, but anyway, he wouldn't do it. And it really niggled and angered Haman. And so he was filled with fury, verse 5. But he dared not lay his hands on Mordecai alone, or at least he disdained to do so. Instead, he decided that he would have all the Jews throughout the empire put to death. So he went into the king, and he said to the king, King Ahasuerus, there is a people in your empire who have different laws and a different culture, and they don't keep your laws, and it would be better if they were executed. And if you will give a decree to that end, I will give you from their treasuries that we will appropriate £3 million. And the king was very greedy, and also he felt threatened, and so he gave decree that all Jews throughout his empire should be put to death. Now, Haman wanted to know the day on which this should be done. And he was a superstitious man, so he cast lots or threw a dice. Look at verse 7 of chapter 3. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast pure. That is the lot. Before Haman, day after day, they cast it month after month. That doesn't mean every month they cast it. They meant they were trying to find out in which month should be this genocide, extermination of a race. And it went right through to the 11th month, well, 11 more months, to the 12th month. And so that did give them some time to do something about it. That was to be his lucky day, as he thought, when Mordecai would die because all the Jews would die. So the king's secretaries went all over the provinces, right from one end of his empire to the other, with this decree. We know from Greek historians that Xerxes, or Ahasuerus, was a very cruel man, as well as a very sensuous man. So Esther, the queen, had married a tyrant. Now, chapter 4, Mordecai learned about this, and he put on sackcloth and ashes, that was a symbol of mourning, and he went out into the midst of the city with a loud and bitter cry. And so did every Jew throughout the empire. It was a sort of Persian version, if you'll forgive that unintended bit of rhyming, of what happened in the Third Reich of Adolf Hitler in the same day and generation of many of us here tonight. Every Jew to be persecuted, every Jew to be rounded up, eventually every Jew to be exterminated. It's happened to them right through their history, yet God has preserved them. And that itself is a testimony and a miracle in many people's eyes. Now, what's to be done? Well, they're all mourning, and Esther, the queen, even though she's in the palace and in great luxury and everything, she gets to hear of it, and she wonders whatever is going on. So she sends one of her great servants, who'd been appointed to look after her, she sends him out to Mordecai to ask what the trouble is. And Mordecai tells him to go and tell the queen what the decree is, and even to give him a copy of it, and then ask her to go into the king and have it reversed, to use her influence as his wife, as the queen, to have it reversed or in some way stayed. She sends word back again. She couldn't possibly do that, because nobody was allowed to go into the king unless they were called. Even the queen, if she went into the king's throne room without being sent for or called, she would be put to death, unless, as a special act of grace, he held out his scepter. And she hadn't been called for 30 days, and so she dare not do it. So Mordecai sent her back this word. It starts at verse 13 of chapter 4. "Think not that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. But you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" That is the key text of the book. Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Well, she was moved by that reply, and so she sent a reply back through the intermediary to her cousin and guardian, the Jew Mordecai. She said, "Gather all the Jews that you can then in Susa, hold a fast on my behalf for 3 days. I think that implies prayer, fasting and prayer. My maids and I will do the same, and then I will go into the king, although it's against the law." And she says, "If I perish, I perish." And so Mordecai went and did everything she said. Right into chapter 5. She goes into the palace. She put on her queenly royal robes. She went into the palace. They've excavated this palace. It was a magnificent palace of various courts and ascending staircases, all with the throne at the far end of a marble hall, 65 feet high and very long. And in goes Queen Esther. And the king held out his golden scepter, and she was allowed to approach and touch the top of it. And he said, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you to the half of my kingdom." And all she said was, "Will it please the king?" that you and Haman, the Prime Minister, whom you've appointed to be the Prime Minister, will you come to a banquet tonight that I have prepared for you? He said, we certainly will. And so he sent for Haman, and the two of them went to the dinner. And when they were there, he knew that it wasn't just the dinner. And so he said to Esther, what is it that you want of me? I'll give it to you up to the half of my kingdom. And she said, will you please, with Haman, come to dinner again tomorrow? And so he agreed that he would come to dinner tomorrow with Haman. And so he, the king, went back to his palace, and Haman went out glad of heart, chapter 5, verse 9. But, blow me down, as he went out, he had to pass Mordecai in the king's gate. And everybody else was trembling and bowing down, but this stubborn Jew would not do it. And he went home in a right old tizzwas, and he said to his wife, and he said to his friends, look, he said, I'm the Prime Minister of the land, Haman. Everybody bows down to me. I've got riches without number. I've got as much promotion as I could wish for. Even the queen is honouring me. She'll have nobody with the king but me. And yet, all this, verse 13, chapter 5, does me no good so long as I see that Mordecai Jew sitting at the king's gate. So they said, well, why don't you build a big gallows 85 feet high and hang him on it? And he said, that's exactly what I'll do. So he had this big gallows built, and he planned to hang him on it. Now, that night, chapter 6, that night the king couldn't sleep. He'd taken all his pills, his sleeping pills, and he couldn't sleep. So he decided he would get out the minute books. Sometimes at the deacons' meetings we have to send for the minute books of years gone by to see what minutes were kept. And it was rather funny for him to do that because he couldn't sleep. But he said, get the minute books out. Let's read a bit of history and see what's happened in the past. And he was reading in this book, and he came to see about a chap called Mordecai, who had once saved his life. And he said to his servants, has anything ever been done for that man? And they said, no, nothing. Well, he said, we're going to put that right. He saved my life from assassination. Is anybody around of importance? Yes, they said, Haman, the Prime Minister, is around. He said, call him in. So Haman came in. And the king said to Haman, what do you think should be done for somebody in whom the king delights to honour? Well, thought Haman, he must mean me. He must mean me. Who would the king delight to honour but me? And so you can read about it in chapter 6. He said, well, sir, I would say that a person whom the king delights to honour should be robed up in royal robes, brought out, put on the king's horse with the king's royal crown on his head. And, ooh, he was a big head, was this Haman. And he said, and let him ride throughout the land, and everybody should cheer him, and so on, right through the city. And so the king Ahasuerus or Xerxes said to Haman, right, that's a good idea. I want you to do it for a chap called Mordecai the Jew. And Haman had to do it for his worst enemy. And he did just that. All right, so Mordecai was honoured at last. Well came the time of the banquet, chapter 7. They went to the feast with Queen Esther. And Ahasuerus asked her again, what do you really want? And this time she told him. She said, we want our life to be spared. Somebody has turned your heart against my people, the Jews. We wouldn't have minded being put into slavery, but to be slain and annihilated and destroyed, why should that happen? And he loved his queen, and he said, who is he that has done this thing? And she said, the wicked Haman. And the king was so angry that he went out into the garden, and Haman cast himself before and even upon Esther to plead for his life, so that when the king came back, he said, will this man even assault my own wife in my own presence? And somebody came and told him that he'd had a gallows built 85 feet high to hang Mordecai on. So the king said, hang him on it. And so he was hung upon the gallows that he had prepared for someone else. I believe in the navy it would be called hoist with his own petard. I wonder what happened to his lucky day, by the way. Put not your trust in dice or superstition or astrology. Well, the laws of the Medes and Persians couldn't be changed, so we must cut the story short now. The king issued a new decree. And the new decree was that on the day that had been appointed, the Jews should be allowed to defend themselves. That the princes of the various areas should assist them, and that instead of their enemies prevailing over them, they should prevail over them. And so, on that appointed day of the month of Adar, which later they knew as Purim, Lots, because he'd come to it, had their enemy Haman by the casting of Purim, Lots, the 12th month, there was a great execution, not of the Jews, but of those who were their enemies. They came in first. And Mordecai was given the prime minister's place in the place of the late Haman. I'm sad to say that in chapter 9, when Esther is asked if there's anything else that she would like, she asked for another day when the Jews could have mastery over their foes. And it does seem like a little bit of vindictiveness to some people. Well, then to the end of the book, the writer tells us that that is how, under the instructions of Mordecai, they came to remember every year, verse 26 of the 9th chapter, Purim, Lots, after the term pure, the feast, because they remembered how they had been delivered when, but for Queen Esther and Mordecai, they would have been put to death and slaughtered. What are the lessons then to be learned from this book? Surely the first lesson is God is working his purpose out. Xerxes thought that he was the greatest king that there had ever been, and he left instructions to that end. By the way, it wasn't long before he was assassinated. But God is on the throne, and God was working his purposes out. Says Matthew Henry, if the name of God is not here, his finger is. By which he means the providence of God working out his purposes. And that, in a way, is all the more remarkable in the way it comes out, the fact that God's name is not here. Secondly, we learn that Satan cannot stop the purposes of God. Haman is a type of Satan, the enemy of God's people, and the enemy, therefore, of God. For anyone who is the enemy of God's people is the enemy of God. You see, if these Jews had been slaughtered as Haman wanted, then there would have been no Ezra and no Nehemiah, and then would have been no Jesus of Nazareth. But it was God's purpose that the Jews should go back and rebuild the walls, and it was God's purpose that of Mary should be born a Saviour, Christ the Lord. And Satan cannot, through any of his agencies, stop God. Indeed, he usually overreaches himself, as indeed this man did here. Thirdly, human responsibility cannot stop the purposes of God either. That's why I like that passage in chapter 4, where Mordecai challenges his cousin, the beautiful Queen Esther. He says, if you keep silence at such a time as this, 4:14, as you may well choose to do, God's purposes will not be overthrown. Relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter. Do you see that? He was firmly convinced that God would deliver his people, if not through Esther, then through someone else. His purposes cannot be overthrown even by a failure of a man or a woman to do their duty. But you and your father's house will perish. God will not save you if you don't do your duty, Esther. Why should he? But then who knows? Who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Is that not the great lesson for us? Even though God is sovereign and is working his purposes out, we may have a part in that plan, and we have our duty to do. You in your place of work, you in this church, you in the place where God has put you are just as vital as Queen Esther. How did she know what God was doing? She was just challenged that she had a duty to do on one day, even though it may cost her life. And she did it. And I believe that there are hundreds of Esthers here tonight of both sexes, and of all ages, in a sense. And you have, and I have, a duty to do. And it may well be costly. And God says, will you do your duty or will you not? Have I not brought you to this place, to this day, for such a time as this? Will you do it? Or haven't you got the courage to do it? For I will be with you. Said Samuel Rutherford, duties are ours. Events are the Lord's. You a person who does his duty, her duty? May it please God that this shall be a church of people who do the right thing when challenged, for his name's sake.